The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
There are lawyers and law firms that it's all bottom dollar. And they're typically the ones that ends justify the means, because they don't see it as an honorable profession. It's just a way to make some money.
Keith Mitnick of Morgan & Morgan addresses whether the practice of law has become too much a big business and the hard lesson he learned about ethics.
He said you'd never say anything to another lawyer that isn't absolutely true. Or just don't say it, because if you do, you're ruined in this town. Ruined.
And how problems with a case usually aren't.
If in your heart of hearts as a lawyer, you go, my cases are riddled with all these problems, then you're not as happy practicing law, and you're more likely to settle the case to discount it, and you're more scared to try it. When you realize those were never problems, then you love your cases, which means you love what you do, which means you're not going to give the case away until they pay you right, and you'll damn sure go try it.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. His parents were school teachers, so it's no surprise that part of Keith Mitnick's practice at Morgan & Morgan in Orlando is to counsel other lawyers. He has a reputation as the go-to guy who helps turn seeming problems into solutions. He's going to share some of those lessons with us today, so grab a pen and a pad of paper. He prides himself as an inventor, a process guy who has developed systems to improve trial tactics, which he gladly shares with others. Otherwise, he's in court trying a case or preparing for the next one. He tries about 14 to 16 cases a year. Keith Mitnick sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in July 2020 to talk about his humble roots, what he thinks about lawyers doing TV commercials, and his insight on how to balance professional life with family life.
Keith, when many people think of the law firm of Morgan & Morgan, it's the prolific television commercials that likely come to mind and the marketing appeal of trying the case. And you are sometimes referred to as John Morgan's set of teeth. Is that a fair assessment?
It's an old assessment. There was an article many years ago in the Orlando Sentinel that was a feature story on me. And someone said something to the effect I was his teeth or his bulldog or something like that. And it stuck for a while. I thought that kind of died out. But here's the reality, whatever phrase you put on it. I was his original trial specialist. I didn't work up cases, and I just went to trial to make sure we had an experienced guy in the courtroom with our lawyers that are very, very good lawyers, but they weren't just trial specialists. So that was my role, and that's where that name came from. As we've evolved over time, we have other trial specialists. I'm no longer the sole guy doing it, but I still do it.
And you've been with the firm for a long time now.
Oh, yeah. I'm coming up on 25 years now.
Well, tell us, what's your typical role in a case, in a trial?
Yeah, I like I said, I will attend importance, for example, a videotape of an expert for trial where we're going to do the cross-examination. It's their witness. I'll often go do those. I show up sometimes at important mediations or important hearings. But typically, my role is I get the case before trial. They fill me in on it right before trial, and I learn it, and I'm a quick study. And I learn it and I step in and I typically take the lead at trial, but whoever worked it up tries it with me. And I mean, splits the trial. It's not like I hog all this stuff, but I typically take the lead seat at trial. And the vantage, honestly, that I find is I'm seeing the case more like jurors see it. It's washing over me all at one time, as opposed to having taken that long roller coaster of working a case up for a year or 2 years or more. So I think it's an advantage, but you know, there's a lot of learning at the last minute, but it comes together well.
You're helping with the jury selection. You're doing the opening and the closing arguments typically then?
Yeah, the typical breakdown. Now, there are exceptions. Now, you know, I have lawyers say, I want to do opening. And my God, it's their case. If that's their desire, they do it. But the typical model is I do the jury selection. I do the opening. They usually put on the directs. And then when we get to cross-examinations, I usually do most of the cross-examinations. And then I will do the closing argument.
And when you say you're a trial specialist, I mean, you actually spend a lot of time in court in a year, don't you?
Yes, I do. Here's the fact of the matter. It is rare that I do not have more than one trial on my calendar for any week of the year. As we all know, sometimes they clear. And when the dust settles, it usually means a minimum of one trial a month. It's not unusual to have four, but the range is usually 2 to 4 trials, jury trials a month. And that, you know, over the year, that adds up to 14, 15, 16, sometimes more trials in a given year. So it's a broad spectrum of types of trial, which I love because it keeps it fascinating and interesting and challenging for me.
Sure. Well, your largest verdict, at least so far, was $90 million. And at the time, back in 2010, that was one of the top 10 cases in the United States. It was a early Engle progeny case involving a tobacco company. But one of your most noteworthy cases, at least to me, seems to be the one that lasted 9 years and threw out 3 trials. Tell us about that one.
It was a medical malpractice case. I owe a lot to that case because a lot of what I teach on now, a lot that's in my book, Don't Eat the Bruises, a lot of the lessons came out of that crazy, what turned out to be almost like a Petri dish experiment, because the other side was twisting facts around. And I went to trial the first time and I brought one of my partners and we lost it, but we got a new trial on a manifest way to the evidence. Some things happened in the trial really shouldn't have happened. And the judge said new trial. Of course, they appealed that. We won the appeal. Now I come back a second time, but now I know what they're doing in opening. So I start designing an opening to head off what they were up to. We try it again. We get a 5-1 against us hung jury. 5-1 against. Hung damn jury. We now have to tee it up and try it a third time. First one, I brought one of my partners. Second one, that guy didn't say, I don't want to come again for 2-week med mal. Brought a second partner, different partner. Third go around. Nobody would come with me. They'd had enough. I tried that 2-week trial all by myself in a med mal case. But this time I said, you know what? I did better in opening to take their stuff away, but I could have done even better. So the third one, I crushed their misleading opening statement in my opening statement while keeping the high ground. And it taught me a lesson I've been trying to teach others ever since then, how to win an opening statement. And guess what? I won, got $1 million verdict. I told the two guys that came with me the first go to, I said, hey, buddy, I now know what the problem was. It was you. As soon as I got rid of you, we won. The story still wasn't over. They appealed that one. And finally, the appellate court said, enough's enough, a per curiam affirm. And after 9 years, 3 2-week jury trials and 2 full-blown appeals that I did by rote and argued myself back in those days, we finally had a happy ending.
That's interesting because, you know, in typical trials, you don't get a redo. And you managed to get, I mean, not by design, I know, a couple of redos. Let's pick up on what you said about opening arguments. You learned some valuable lessons that you're trying to get other lawyers to realize and utilize. And I know you're a big process person, but tell us that advice right now.
Yeah, the short version of it is this. It's not enough to pat yourself on the back when you are done with your side of opening. You got to remember, they're going to get a shot. And if you go take a break and run to the restroom and everyone says, boy, that was really good. But when they finish and you're heading to lunch, your head's hanging down low and you're going, well, I'll get them later. I'm going to teach them a lesson for mislead. It wasn't a very good opening. It's only good enough if you're patting yourself on the back after they're done. And that's easier said than done, because if you're not careful, you'll end up trying their case on their issues. So there's some very artful ways to destroy their case in your opening while still trying your case and staying on the high ground. And you're, when you talk about their stuff, you're not making apologies. You're exposing some misleading things that are going to happen. And you have to do it carefully because you're not allowed to argue. So I have come up with systems that can be reproduced by any lawyer in any case, so that when you come out of void iron opening, I call it winning at the beginning, you're ahead. Because if you're not ahead after opening, you're in trouble. And then you run like the Dickens and don't let them catch you and bring it home and close it.
Well, and when you're not actually in court trying cases, well, I mean, one of your roles there at the firm, you do a lot of counseling, a lot of teaching, don't you? A lot of seminars.
I do a lot. We call them, I have a podcast that I do. I go up to New York City. Can't go up there now in a professional studio. And I do these little like 15-minute audio podcasts on all these new ideas. So internally, and I call them brushstrokes. And internally, I do brushstrokes for our young guns, which are our younger, newer lawyers. And I do brushstrokes for the whole firm on a every month basis. I do one of each. So I do a lot of that teaching. And then also when I'm not in trial, I am always available to talk to our lawyers. Anybody got a strategic question, they're stumped with something, they're concerned about something, I'm kind of the problem solver and the person who teaches them how to get their best foot forward. And a lot of it's more senior lawyers that don't need teaching. They just need, you know, two heads are better than one. I am a natural born, I don't see problems, I see solutions. That's just how I'm wired. So
as a senior trial lawyer who assists other attorneys, especially the young ones, as you said, how do you find the quality of young lawyers today?
Fantastic. I've told John Morgan that honestly, when this new, he talks about freshmen, sophomores, seniors, you know, juniors, and he looks at it as classes because we're so big and been around so long. I have to tell you, I'm a senior, but when he talks about, when we talk about the freshmen, I say, let me tell you something, John, I know these freshmen and I'm telling you, and hell, he hired a lot of them, so he does, but I tell him, I believe the freshman class is going to be better than any class we've ever had overall. Not that we don't have superstars in every class, but I think per capita, this young group that we have are going to set the world on fire. And they're hungry and they listen and they're smart and they care and they believe and they excite me greatly.
Some good qualities that you just mentioned there. Now, I know you said you handle a variety of cases. I mean, obviously what they have in common is personal injury, but you've been involved in a myriad of high profile cases involving entertainers throughout your career. I mean, we're talking Britney Spears, the Backstreet Boys, there were two Harlem Globetrotters that had an issue with the team, the civil lawsuit against Casey Anthony there in Orlando. You seem to have a niche for trying those cases.
I do. Clay, I've got a partner of mine who's a dear friend of mine who's a brilliant lawyer named Clay Townsend. And he's got a niche into this entertainment world. And he's gotten the cases and he and I work them together and try them together. And the Harlem Globetrotters case is one of the most enjoyable things I've ever been involved in. The Harlem Globetrotters were using Curly Neal, Metamark Lemon, Marcus Haynes, Gator Rivers, Showboat, a bunch of the ones I grew up with. They were using their name and likeness on these FUBU urban jerseys and not paying them. And Clay got a hold of it. He knew Curly Neal. We represented them all, brought that case in federal court out in Phoenix, suing the Globetrotter organization for money we say they owed them. And they were defending on contracts that were signed before civil rights, and they weren't right and they weren't fair. And we ended up trying the case for a few days and resolved it in a way that is confidential, but was fair and reasonable. But going to dinner and having a meal and a cocktails and listening to those legends tell stories from all over the world, and then have them look to you after as much as I looked up to them as kids, that they have them when we walked into that courtroom, which is my court, and have them look to you and look up to you and appreciate your craft was one of the most meaningful experiences in my 36 plus years.
Wow. Keith, what's your view on settling a case versus going to trial?
Well, John Morgan said, I'm going to advertise, but I'm not going to be like an advertising firm, way back when advertising wasn't cool. And he said, we're going to try cases. And that's how he ended up bringing me over. 4 years, I had my own firm. I said, no. But I said it gentlemanly because I was watching him take over the world. And I'd say, John, thank you. We go to dinner every damn year around Christmas and eat a steak. And he'd make a pitch. And I'd say, thank you, but I just can't do it. And finally, after 4 years, I said yes. And I've been there ever since. I tell people I have one regret for saying yes. I didn't say it the first year because I got to do what I do best, which is just try cases. And it just allowed me to become the best person I could be with my particular skill set. But having said that, back to the question, we've always been wired at Morgan & Morgan, try them, don't settle them unless they're fair and reasonable. But my personal view on it is this. Insurance companies don't voluntarily pay fair and reasonable settlements. They have to be made. There's only one way to make them. You got to beat them in trial. You got to say no. And you got to walk in that courtroom knowing I'm not going to win every one. But by God, I'm going to win a bunch of them, and I'm going to win them for a whole lot more than you are willing to offer. And the next time I sit across the table from you in mediation and you tell me the case isn't worth it, I'm going to look at it and say, what about? And then if you don't get reasonable, I'm going to drag your behind the court. And over the years of doing that, the settlements get fair and reasonable. Not always. So at the short answer to, I gave a long answer. Let me give you the short answer. Here's what I think about settlements and trials. Settlements are great for your client. You got to try a bunch of cases to get settlements that are fair and reasonable, or they'll take advantage of you.
Let's go back to the beginning. What made you want to be a lawyer in the first place?
You know, that's a strange question. And that's not a strange question. I got a bit of an odd answer. My mother, who was a guidance counselor, both my parents were school teachers. And I think I got that teacher blood in me. That's why I spend so much time teaching. And I think I've just wired that way. But they weren't lawyers. I didn't even know a lawyer. Nonetheless, my mother talked to the guidance counselor at my school. She was at Mount Dora High. I was over at Eustis. And she found from the guidance counselor, who was a colleague and friend, that as early as elementary school, every single review, all the way through when I graduated high school, what do you want to be? Lawyer. So I've been asked that question, and here's my best answer, but I don't have a clear answer. I don't know where the hell it came from. It's the truth. But I suspect it was Perry Mason, because there are a million lawyer shows on TV now. But back then, it was Perry Mason. And I loved that show. I absolutely loved it. That and Mission Impossible. But when I was really young, it was Perry Mason. And all I can think is, I love the drama of that courtroom. I love the good guy winning and the bad guy losing. And it must have somehow got in my little brain as a kid, and I couldn't shake it loose. I never once said I'm going to be anything but.
I've heard part of what drives you is you don't like bullies. Did that come from any particular place?
It's probably come out of my mouth. I've been saying my whole life, I hate bullies. And I do. I have no tolerance for bullies. And I think it is a driving desire in my practice that I see the other side, in most cases, as bullying our client. And I had someone ask me not long ago, why do you think that is? Where do you think that did someone bully you? And my first knee-jerk reaction was, no, you know, I'm an old football player. I was a middle linebacker and you know, pretty good. And I to admit you ever got bullied to me is embarrassing. And I couldn't remember ever being bullied. And then they paused a second. And I was thinking, could I have been? And it's like a repressed memory. It was strange. I remembered at that moment, this has been within the last month, that younger as a kid, that some bully who was much older than me in school, he's a kid that had flunked three or four times and was a big kid and meaner than hell. And about once every 2 weeks, he was beating the hell out of somebody in the schoolyard and getting suspended. And it was always a bloody mess. So he was an intimidating guy. And he walked up, and I was running with the, let's say, popular class. So I would have been a target of him. He was kind of in a rough class. And that kid came up to me and hit me with a board hard on the behind in front of my friends and his friends. And the damn board had a nail sticking out of it. Oh. And it hurt like someone just electrified me. And I turned around just shocked. It literally felt like a shock. And I turned around and he laughed and his friends laughed and my friends watched what I was going to do. And I didn't do anything. And I went home and I remember telling my mom, who was the sweetest, nurturing person. And my dad overheard it in the other room, who was a good man, but he wasn't a nurturer. He was a take no shit guy. And my dad came in and he said, "You can't ever let anyone bully you like that. Period. Do you understand?" Now I was doubly hurt. I had physically hurt. I was embarrassed that I didn't stand up, and now I am ashamed to my father in here whining to my mother. God almighty, I hate saying this out loud. I'm about ready to tell you to edit it out. But having said it, it never happened again. I never started a fight in high school. I'm not wired that way, but I damn sure finished a lot of them. And so I think I've spent my life proven to my dad, who's passed away, bullies don't mess with me. And I think that pain of that moment instilled this hatred for bullies because I know what it does to other people. And by God, I've been the anti-bully ever since.
Wow. After high school, you went to University of Central Florida undergrad, Florida State University Law School. You had a firm at one point, but after law school, did you have a mentor in your early days?
Yeah, I did. I had two of them that were fantastic. Right out of law school, I never even interviewed. I worked for them. Long story I won't tell, but I ended up fortunate enough. I worked for these great lawyers in Orlando, two of the best ever, and they have them in partners. And I worked for them during the summer before I got out of law school, and they hired me before I went back and finished. And it was John Robertson and Hubert Williams. And Hubert was a no-nonsense work, 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 work. He was a guy, it's 90% work effort. You outwork the other side and 10% talent, period. Great lawyer, but he was just a grinder. And I learned to grind. You left no stone unturned or you were scolded severely. And so he was an integral part of my, not work ethic, because I was already a worker, but of my detail-oriented side when in law. But Hubert Williams was that guy. The other guy with John Robertson, and what he taught me was all these things that you go, "Oh my God, it's a bad fact." He would shame you for reacting that way. I'd come back from a deposition and say, "Oh, let me tell you, John, we got this, this witness said it really is a problem." And he'd look at me like he wanted to spit on me and say, "Mitnick, that's not a problem. That's a good fact." And he proceeded to tell me why it was. Now, it wasn't always. Sometimes he was wishful thinking, but a lot of times he was right. And whatever he did, he taught me an attitude as a baby lawyer that has stuck with me ever since. That's why when people come to me all the time with problems, because they know Mitnick's going to have an answer. And most of them, by the end, I convince them they never were a problem to start with. And all of that started with Robertson.
So the lesson there is that problems are often opportunities.
Absolutely. Perfect way to put it. And here, I'll say it another way. I tell our lawyers all the time, we don't run from problems. We run at them.
Mm.
We don't disc out. We deal with them. And the truth is, there are going to be problems in cases. I mean, goodness gracious, your client swears they couldn't work, and they got them on film working and getting paid under the table. I mean, that's a problem. But so many of the things people think are problems, you know, you don't have a lot of visible property damage in a car crash case, or the person went to the doctor for a while and then didn't go for a while and then returned. They call it a gap in treatment. And all I can go on and on and on. They had some prior crashes in the past with some problems. And people go, oh, that's a problem. I go, no, it is not. And then I start proving to the lawyer why it's not. And the lawyer goes, it's not. And you know why that's so profound? You still have to deal with it. And there are very effective ways to get the same proof across to a jury. It's not a problem. But if in your heart of hearts as a lawyer, you go, my cases are riddled with all these problems, then you're not as happy practicing law. And you're more likely to settle the case to discount it. And you're more scared to try it. When you realize those were never problems, then you love your cases, which means you love what you do, which means you're not going to give the case away until they pay you right. And you'll damn sure go try it. So it's a profound difference. So those are the kind of things that are core to what I try to pass on to other lawyers. I am constantly trying to show other lawyers, don't take my word for it. I'm going to prove to you how you deal with these things, but you're not dealing with a problem. You're revealing the fact they never were a problem to start with. Your cases are good cases.
Keith, tell us about the role that ego plays in being a good lawyer.
It's essential, and that sounds funny because you'd like to say, oh, we're all humble and selfless, but the reality is this. What we do is hard. We're on the spotlight. We've got people that come to us and pick us to stand up for them when they couldn't stand up for themselves in this legal environment. That's a great honor, but a heck of a responsibility. And you better have an ego to be the guy that's going to stand, or lady that's going to stand up for them. And I tell lawyers all the time this. I don't know of another profession other than professional athletes where there's someone on the other side who's highly trained, experienced, well paid, and their sole purpose in life is to try to screw up every single thing you try to accomplish. And that isn't for everyone, but if you can handle it, what an exciting, challenging way to make a living. But at the end of that, you can't survive, let alone thrive in that world, if you don't have a healthy ego.
How do you handle disappointment? You can't win every case.
No, I wish I could. I hate losing, but I do. Anyone that says they don't isn't telling you the truth, or they got a weird definition of winning or losing, or they aren't trying cases. So yes, it's part of it. I've told a lot of lawyers this, so I'm glad you asked that. Fear can be debilitating or it can be motivating. Never let it turn you into being scared, but never lose your brokenheartedness with a loss, because you need that, because it is an extraordinary motivator. So how do I use that motivation after a loss, when I'm just broken and I am broken? Number one, I use it to light a Bunsen burner over my behind to focus on new strategies to minimize the chance of feeling like this ever again. Not that I lost it because you did something wrong, but it's I could do something even more right. And number two is this, get back in the saddle. Go win the next one, and all of a sudden, you'll never forget that last one, but by God, you'd be like you took a happy pill.
Ongoing reflection, certainly continuous training, seems to have played an important role in your evolution as a trial lawyer and what you instill in others. Keith, why is it important for you to be involved with the Florida Justice Association? How has that impacted you?
Profoundly. And the reason is this. It's really two things for me, because I don't run for office, and I should. It's important, but it's just not, you know, you use your gifts in the best possible way you can. And I'm not good with the politics. And that's not my gift. And I'm so grateful we have so many that are, that spend their time, like one of my partners, Xander Clam, who's a past president. And without them, we'd all be out of business. But that's just not where I put my efforts. Where I put my efforts in it is helping to share and teach at seminars, or having other lawyers, brothers and sisters in arms that are in the organization, call and ask questions or send an email, and I'm always available to help with it. And so I share and do my part, but everyone in that organization, the closeness, the sharing, the look out for each other's back, very little pettiness. It's just an organization that big that is that bonded is extraordinary. And without them, the legislatures in Florida would have destroyed our clients' rights and our profession. So they have kept this honorable profession alive. And what a wonderful place to just have a bunch of people that know what you go through and can share in your pain as well as your pleasures of being a trial lawyer who represents injured people.
Mm. Well, we've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
No. I'm an old school guy. I believe, and I know the general public may, some folks think poorly of us, and I know there are lawyers out there that I think have done a total disservice on both sides. On both sides, plaintiff and defendant, because they do believe win at all costs. Nobody wants to win hard more than I do. Nobody fights harder than I do. But you fight hard, but you play and fight fair. You don't cheat. You don't lie, because I believe this is one of the most honorable professions in America. And by God, we've got a duty and a responsibility to maintain ethics and character and dignity and class. We can fight bloody one another, but we don't lie to each other. We don't cheat to each other. And when we see someone who does, then they ought to be ostracized and thrown out. Because honestly, the public sees us and we have to stand upright and other lawyers see us. If you don't mind, I'm going to tell one quick story on that.
Sure.
When I was a baby lawyer, the same guy I just talked about as my mentor, who was such an influence on me, he's passed away, but he's in my prayers every morning. John Robertson. I'll never forget, because he was a street fighter and brilliant. I mean, vicious street fighter. And we had this fight with another lawyer who was cheating, and we hated him, and he did all this dirty stuff. And we were in an old house, beautiful old house on Lake Eola in Orlando, is where our office was. And he was at one side upstairs, I was at the other, and because it was an old house, there was an adjoining bathroom with two doors. You could come in from his or mine into this old bathroom in there. And the doors often were open. We'd holler back and forth, so the doors were open. And this lawyer, who had done so many things wrong, calls me up and asks something. And if we had a trap, a legitimate trap, but a trap, and I couldn't answer his question without giving the trap away. And I knew I couldn't give the trap away, and I couldn't stand the guy anyway. So I said, he asked, what about so-and-so? I said, no. And it wasn't a lie, but it wasn't being straight up honest. It was somewhere in between. And I hung up the phone, and Robertson hollers through. Did he ask about? I said, yeah. Did I just hear you say no? I said, yeah. You wanted me to tell him? He goes, no, avoid the question. Hang up. Do anything. He said, you'd never say anything to another lawyer that isn't absolutely true, or just don't say it. Because if you do, you're ruined in this town. Ruined. And I tell you what, I love that guy. And that's hurt. And it stuck with me. And I thought, you know, you're such a hard player. I didn't expect it. And it changed my view. You play hard. No one pushes you around. But by God, you tell people the truth and act admirable in this profession, or you're done. And I believe that, and I've told every young lawyer in our office that story.
That's a powerful story. Keith, as you've said this and know very well, this is a profession with very, very long hours, very complex, very difficult work. How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
It's easy for me because it's the boundaries between them almost don't exist. But I've got a unique situation. My wife was a court reporter for like 25 years. She's been in front of more juries than I do. And she's as passionate, maybe more passionate, about not letting people pull off an injustice, and not on my watch. Now, everybody isn't married to another lawyer or to somebody who's worked in the law business and shares that same insight and passion and experience. So what do you do? Here's the best advice to it. Include your spouse, even if they're not in the field somehow. Don't say, I want to leave work at work and come home and I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want to bring it home. I need a break. Well, now your wife or your husband's left out. Now when you have to put in those hours, now when you're gone for trial, now when you're heartbroken after one, now when you're celebrating and you're on top of the world, they're not part of it. And what does that lead to? It leads to two separate lives. It leads to resentment. And if you include your wife, you include your husband, you talk about your cases, you ask for their input. And they don't need to be insiders to have great input. They will think like jurors and respect their input. You don't have to just say you're right, but listen to it and go back and forth with them. And next thing, they don't resent your career because they're a significant part of your career. And if you're going to spend that much of your soul and your time, and you've got a soulmate, why wouldn't you bring your soulmate along and share in the journey? And I think that's the way you make a marriage work and be committed and dedicated the way you have to be great as a trial lawyer. You can have your cake and eat it too. Just be aware.
That sounds like some terrific advice. Keith, we hear the criticism from some that law has become too much of a commodity, too much of a business, meaning profit motive, versus a force for societal benefit and change, the client, the pure client motive. What do you think of that? Has law become too much of a business?
It depends. For some, and for those that do, think of it as a pure business. There's nothing wrong with wanting to make money from the practice of law. Absolutely. You ought to. You want to be successful, which means you're going to make money. But when the money becomes the driving force, not the consequence of doing it right, now you got a problem. And there are lawyers and law firms that it's all bottom dollar. And they're typically the ones that ends justify the means. Because they don't see it as an honorable profession. It's just a way to make some money. And you know what I say to them? Shame on you. But do I think that the majority of plaintiff's lawyers? Absolutely, I do not. Not saying it doesn't exist, but the vast majority, because of this organization, almost every plaintiff lawyer is or ought to be in Florida Justice Association. And so you get to meet them and talk to them. Those people aren't driven by the bottom line. They want the money, but they're driven by, I'm standing up to bully, or I'm fighting for justice. My client deserves their day in court, and by God, they deserve a fair and reasonable result, and I'm going to do everything in my power to get there. This is the honest to God truth. I have never, ever tried a case and done math about if we get X, how much will that put in my pocket? Ever. And the day I do, I'll hang up, do something else.
The commercials we see on TV sometimes seem to be all about the money.
Yep. I don't like them. I don't like them because it's the wrong image. People got a constitutional right to do it. There's a lot of stuff when I turn on the news I hear that people say, and I don't like it. But I don't get to be the censor. I don't have a problem with ads, for God's sake. I'd be a big hypocrite. But ads that give the impression it's a money grab make me ill.
Keith, how would you like to be remembered?
You know, I'm sure everyone that you've interviewed has wanted to be remembered for accomplishments in the courtroom. And not just all the great verdicts, but the stories that go with them. Great trial lawyers all want not just to say, man, look at all these verdicts in the significant verdicts. They want them to be telling stories about them. They want to be legendary stories and folklore. It's part of that question you asked me before about ego. So yeah, I want to be remembered. I want people to tell stories about, remember when Mitnick this or Mitnick that, woo. And I want to be remembered. But honestly, there's another piece of it that may be a little more unique to me that I would rather emphasize. And I want to be remembered as somebody who was constantly inventing ways to head off unfair tactics by the defense, constantly inventing ways that could help get a just result that's deserving and righteous for our clients. And that he didn't just invent them and hoard them like some top secret with a patent on it. He shared them with everybody. He shared them in every way he possibly could. That's what I would love for people to say. We all know about that ideal of a rising tide lifts all boats. And Mitnick, boy, did he lift the boats. He didn't preach it. He practiced it. Because if that's my legacy, honestly, then in the end, I can kiss the love of my life, my wife, and hold her one last time and close my eyes and rest in peace.
Keith Mitnick, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.